Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Bravo. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org. It's the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. That's the spiritual universe. It's also the universe where people don't know what addiction looks like. It's really unknown to a lot of folks. If you don't have the disease of addiction, it's kind of an alien planet to you. But I can tell you this, we're not weak people trying to get strong. We're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. And that's what we try to do with Rum Radio. Give you a heads up on that. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who afford us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. They do that because they believe in the work that we're doing, and they do this as a public service. So thank you so much, guys. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. So does the world. Most of the problems we have today is because children were not taught correct principles. They grew up in the mean streets. Quite a few of the time, my experience is that their parents didn't have correct principles, and they're just passing it down to the next generation. You go to the prisons, and the majority of the folks in the prisons are drug and alcohol-related crimes. There's very few career criminals per se. Lots of these crimes have to do with drugs. So this is really deleterious to the country, the moral fabric. There's a lot. So Harold does a really good work. I like to mention that there's a story about a man on a beach, and there's a tide. I think they call it a red tide, and all the starfish, millions of starfish wash up. And he's down there on the beach, and he's flinging back the starfish one at a time. And another guy comes up, and he goes, you know, what are you doing? He's, you know, you're going to only save very few starfish. And he says, I save as many as I can. And that's what we do with Rum Radio. We try to help as many as we can. Can't save them all. It's not meant to work that way. But we help as many as we can. And that's why that's what we do, and that's why we're here. Harold, say hello.
Hello, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here. This is one of the ways that I give back for the much that I've received from 12-step, a bunch of different 12-step programs. And I want to just take a moment to acknowledge Joseph for all the effort he's put in to the website, rumradio.org, and the radio program, Rum Radio. It's a terrific work. He doesn't earn a penny doing it. In fact, it's cost him thousands to begin the website and then improve the website. It's constantly improved. So I really appreciate this opportunity. I am privileged to be here and do the little bit that I can do to help. And I appreciate Joseph for putting in all the effort as his public service. And I appreciate the radio program in Nashville for putting all of this good recovery stuff out there live. We hope that you listeners will hear something that really helps you. And we're kind of back to basics. We want to do the things that Bill W. and Dr. Bob did in the beginning to help one another and then help a lot of people to not return to drinking. So I agree, families are very important, and at the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attend, there's a poster on the wall that says, we're responsible. Whenever someone reaches out, we've got to reach back. And that's the spirit here at rumradio.org. So I'll turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I always appreciate that. Oh, you know, I was given the information that using the term back to basics has now a negative connotation.
Really?
The fellow who started it was bad-mouthing AA, saying that he had a better way. And, of course, now using the word back to basics puts an onus of association. So the point is we're trying to go to the way the original pioneers who started AA worked the program. The big book says 50% got well right away and the other 25% shortly thereafter. And that was great. So they had the right message at that time, and I believe that's the message we need to reinstill in the program. But that's my opinion. If you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. I like to start the program with a third step prayer before I introduce my guest. In the rooms of recovery, the big book says, I think it's on page 89, as memory serves, go find a prospect and start working on them, which makes all the sense in the world. We've developed this philosophy now that the newcomer who has no idea of the culture, the jargon, or what's expected to go find a sponsor, because he doesn't even know what a sponsor is or anything, but this is how we do business now. But the big book says, go find the prospect and start working on them. I try to do that. I get in both ways. Some people seek me out. I seek some out. When I have a potential prospect, usually if we do a prayer at the end. We do a prayer in the beginning. It's called an invocation at the meetings, and that's inviting in the spirit. And at the end, we do a benediction, and the benediction is acknowledging that the spirit was with us. And after the closing prayer, I usually have a hold of the fellow's hand, because most places they hold hands, like a kumbaya kind of deal. And I turn around to him and I ask him, have you had enough? And if he's had enough, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. He might say, what do you mean enough? Well, have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes or no? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. I tell them you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is answer Clancy's 7 questions. I have them on the website. They're under the sponsor tab, how to find a sponsee. Scroll down a little bit. It's all in Word format, so you can do a cut and paste. Excuse me. You can do a cut and paste and carry them with you when you're looking for a sponsee. Stephen Covey said, luck was no more than when preparation met opportunity. So be prepared, and the opportunity will manifest itself. I ask him to answer these 7 questions, and I need him back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. Usually there's a little bit more of a chat that goes on, but that's the initial. Now, this isn't for everybody. This works with my personality, and I find it works well. They demonstrated they can take a simple direction and follow through with it, that they show that their interest level is high enough to work with. They have a good chance of success. And then once I get that back the next day, we're off to the races. If I don't get it back, two things have occurred. They're either not ready or they're not ready for me, which is okay in any event. If I do get it back, the first assignment I give them is to get a home group. This is their lifeline group. This is where they get to meet the other men and the other women in recovery. And in case they need to get more information, they need to place the come instead of the bar, here you go. This is the place. And then to get men's names, men with men, and women with women. We find that to be the most productive. It's easier to identify same gender. Also, sponsorship is a very intimate relationship, which could be easily misconstrued. Sex changes everything. So it's not about romance. This is about life and death. If you can't find the same-sex sponsor, the suggestion is you work the steps. You can always change sponsors. All sponsorship is temporary. It's either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime or anywhere in between. The key to this thing is working the steps in a timely yet thorough manner. Timely is very important. Catch them while they're hot. Catch the pain. Use pain as fuel. So you get that information back. Now he's all ready to go. He's got his lifeline. I ask him to call a different man every day for the next 30 days and ask permission to get a list of the men and get their phone numbers and permission to call them. And then call a different fella every day for the next 30 days and get permission to recite the third step prayer. It accomplishes a few things. One, it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Connects them up with his fellowship. He gets to know their name, and he gets to know their name. So now there's a coalition going there. The third step prayer also encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And the fellow that he's calling, fourthly, might be thinking about picking up his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first. Chances are he will not. There's no guarantee, but your sponsor's already into service work. And this is the prayer. It's also called a surrender prayer. It's not a found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous, but nobody will tell you where to hold the meetings. This is Rum Radio. We don't associate. We're not affiliated with any other 12-step program, although we do use the Big Book because that is the template of all 12-step recovery. I believe going to the source is the greatest amount of knowledge and wisdom to be found there. This is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
So I had an interview last week, and he had a hard time because I said the amen. He says, the amen's not in the book. How dare you put the amen in there? I said, okay. Yeah, I know. I said, that's okay. We'll take the amen out. Amen? All right, so I'd like to introduce our guest. We have a very special guest tonight, Eva Marie Frederick. Frederick.
Frederick.
Okay,
oh,
you got me paranoid now. I wrote it down wrong. And it's on Frederick. She's just been, can I say about the 12 angels?
Certainly.
Yeah, she's just been appointed, I think spiritually, to be in charge of a program called the 12 angels. And it's a program we're going to get into a little later, but it was really quite the honor. She's an artist, she's an actress, she's a director, she lives in Hollywood, or is it Los Angeles? Los Angeles, isn't it?
Los Angeles.
L.A., the city of the angels.
L.A., La La Land.
La La Land, yes it is.
I'm sure.
So tell me now, okay, so we'd like to start out. What was it like before you found recovery, Eva Marie?
What was it like? Well, I was pretty young. First, I want to say to you guys, I don't know if your fathers, Happy Father's Day.
I'm a dad.
Thank you. All the listeners out there. I started drinking very young, so I don't really I started I remember my first blackout at 12. My mother was from Europe, so we were I come from a family of four kids. So basically, you know, I really don't remember my first drink because we the family drank beer a lot. And my parents mixed beer with 7-Up. So, you know, my joke has always been that my mother couldn't breastfeed. So, you know, if she could have, that probably would have been my first drink. So, you know, I started drinking very young, off and on. And I really didn't want to become my family. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I just knew that everybody drank, and that was kind of how our family rolled. And my father worked for the prison system, so it was kind of an interesting household to grow up in. So, in answer to your question, it was just a house of secrets. It was just basically a house of secrets. We didn't talk about what went on. We didn't talk about, you know, what we did. We didn't talk about. It wasn't really a family filled with. You know, I'd go over to my friends' houses and have dinner, and I remember this really distinctly when I was in like third, fourth grade, and I just kind of waited for everyone to start yelling at each other, and everybody just kind of calmly sat there and had a meal, and I thought, there's something wrong with these people. I don't get this. And, you know, so my family was just very, we call it passionate, I guess. They were just really, really loud and very physical in many ways, and it was just a household that you grew up in that everybody drank. So it's not surprising that all of us drank a great deal. And then later,
what's your ethnic background? Was there an ethnic background involved? Or?
Yeah, my mother was German and Austrian. My father was German, French, Mexican, Indian.
Okay. Sometimes there's a connection, you know, with. Not necessarily. I know Italians are very passionate and violent. I'm Italian. That passion goes a long way. A lot of us come in. Some of us are genetically predisposed to be addictive. Mm-hmm. I believe it's the sins of the fathers kind of deal, but it's on a DNA level. Some of us have just drank enough. That we're self-made men, you know. We made the turn. That happens, we don't know for sure. So, but 12 years old—that's amazing. I've never heard anybody with a blackout at that young.
Coming off what you just said. I believe in it's both. You can be genetically predisposed and wait to be activated, or you can become anything you want. So it's you know, those who aren't predisposed can definitely, anyone can become an alcoholic. Just takes practice.
Takes practice.
I like to say where I'm a self-made man.
I can't say that. I can't say that. I'm a woman, but I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah, I'm the only alcoholic really that I know of in my family. That's it. You know, so I'm kind of a really odd duck, and was just that I had drank that much, and to get to that point. My father wasn't a drinker. My mother wasn't a drinker. My brother doesn't drink. You know, my sister's not a drinker. You know, all of that. My kids had a
family where everyone. Yeah.
My kids took after me to some degree. They're either codependents or they're either codependents or alcoholics.
Right. Well, that's probably growing up with it like I did. I there wasn't. anyone in my family that didn't drink, so all of us drank. So it was more of a, you were more of an enigma if you didn't drink. It was, I'm not supposed to speak for others, but I'm just going to say, in my family, everybody pretty much was an alcoholic for the most part. So I lost a brother last summer to the, to the disease, and I lost my mother a couple years ago, and she drank a lot, but, she was from Germany, and Germans love their beer. People tend to think that, beer is not a big deal. Well, it is a big deal. She threw up a liter and a half of blood on getting a bleeding ulcer from drinking beer heavily for years.
Wow.
And almost died at one point. So it's not just the hard booze. It's not just the hard drugs. It's not just the hard anything. I remember very clearly my father telling us, don't smoke pot because you'll do really hardcore drugs. And it was like, you started this on beer and 7-Up when I can't remember. I just remember the first taste of beer was with 7-Up. It tasted very good. And then we graduated to taking sips off bottles. So I don't remember that not being in my life. And actually, I didn't turn out being a heavy beer drinker. I drank other things. But I was a really good bartender.
Ah, mm-hmm. Now, what was the transition between, okay, so you're young, you're growing up now, so this is junior high, you're drinking in junior high, I take it, you're drinking all the way up. Yeah, that's just part of the family, you're eating with meals,
not really with so much with meals, we didn't, my dad was gone a lot. I would just say that, I went through my own periods of just not wanting to be like my parents, and, there was a lot of drama. There was a lot of, violence in the family as far as physical, abuse and stuff. And, it's one of those things that you just really fight so hard not to become something that you become it. And at least for me, it was that story of, I can handle this. I can get, I can control this. And I couldn't. I could for years off and on. But you cross that line and, no, you can't.
10 feet tall and bulletproof.
Yeah, exactly. You become braver, stronger, all that stuff. For me, it was I was an extremely shy kid growing up, and it certainly at least made me a little bit more open and things like that. So I drank off and on pretty much, all growing up, and I kind of. For me, it's like when I had my son, I'll jump ahead, when I had my son, I was sober. And that was an incredible experience. But it took a long time for me to get into the rooms, and then it took me a long time to go back and forth with the rooms and then to come back today.
Yeah, before we jump to that, let me do this. I'd like to give out the guest call-in if there's anybody out there that would like to call in, have any comments or questions. For Eva Marie, it's 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. And Harold, we have the chat room open, perchance?
Yes, the chat room is open. And for all of you who would like to look at Eva Marie's Facebook page, it's spelled two different ways. www.facebook.com/eva.freederick.
No, R-I-C.
Oh, I've got the wrong Facebook page.
You got the wrong person. That's what I'm telling you. That's a different person in a completely different state.
Thank you very much. Okay, I see it now.
It's F-R-E-D-R-I-C.
F-R-E-D-I-C.
No. Fred.
Fred.
R-I-C.
Okay.
Okay.
Terrific.
Right.
And there's a YouTube link here with that name on it also. And what a lovely picture. Okay.
That's actually an older, a couple of years old. That's show by Byron Allen on called The Young Icons, and that my son Dylan Bocanegra, who is an artist, is in that with me. It actually features him primarily to show his work for it, it's to inspire other young to inspire younger kids to go on with their dreams. So it's a
We'll talk about that in a minute, but I'd like to find out. I get a picture of what's going on now. I take it you had a jumping off point, that moment of clarity somewhere along the line. Something happens, something deleterious, something painful, something that makes you come to a realization. What was that like?
Well, you know, I think we all have our stories. Obviously, I had so many bottoms. The only bottom I've got, you know, that I had left was the one I'm sitting on. I had many moments of that. I had many times when I was, you know, wanting to quit and having really rough times. When I lost my husband after we had our son, that was a really difficult time for me. I was, again, as I said, I was sober at the time, and within about 9 months, I started drinking again. And then I went in and out with that for about until my son was six. And I'm not real proud of that. I'm not, it's what it was. And I got sober again when he was in first grade, and I've been sober ever since. And I'm sober 15 and a half, going on 16 years. So,
congratulations.
How many times in and out? Were you a relapse queen? Was it kind of like a relapse queen?
I have lots of relapses. I would sign my own court card. I was a very smart, you know. I mean, if you're not smart enough in that, you know, it's that kind of thing with, I went to AA. I really didn't understand it. I really didn't like it. Then it got to a point where it was, you know, I could kind of manipulate it. I married a guy that became, that was a drug and alcohol counselor. He had over 7 years of sobriety when he died. I was around certainly a lot of recovery at that time, and I found for me that I didn't feel like I had a safe place to get sober again. Before that, it just was a matter of controlled drinking, and you know that story of like, well, I can quit drinking for a while, I can do 6 months, 9 months on my own, it's not a big deal, and it most certainly was. But again, at that time, I was doing a lot of bartending, so it. You know, and I was a really good bartender. I was working on my career, and when you're in bars, it's kind of hard to turn down your own drinks, or people are buying them for you. And So my life at that point was, you know, I just drank a lot. You know, I drank a lot, and I'm not a very big person, so as far as weight-wise, but I drank like Elizabeth Taylor. I had that I could outdrink guys that were easily over 200 pounds. I get out drink pretty much anybody, which I'm not proud of, but it is the truth.
Yeah, that always surprised me. I'm kind of a lightweight when it came to drinking, and I met some women that, like, you know, 5 foot nothing, or, you know, like just barely, and they could drink, which is copious amounts. It just really quite amazed me. I think it has to do with intellect to some degree. I mean, if your mind is really that strong, I think you could sustain it longer. I think it's more of a mental addict than a physical consumption. But that's just an opinion from another alcoholic. So tell me,
right.
So you're in and out of the place, right? You're in and out. Now, your first time, did a sponsor come get you? Did you get a sponsor? Were you counting on the meetings?
Sorry,
recovery?
I missed the very first part of what you said. On my first what?
I know, when you first came in, did a sponsor pick you up? Did you find a sponsor? Did you count on the meetings to
no,
get
it,
sober?
No, as a matter of fact, on my first meeting, it was court mandated, and my mother was visiting, and I took her. She burst into tears listening to the guy that was leading the meeting and said, you know, that poor guy, and I said, Mom, he's like my brothers. I mean, we were listening to what was going on in our family. I didn't really stay in the program at all at that time. It was, it was years later that I did, and that kind of came more out of meeting my son's father. I would say that he's the one that taught me to, you know, embrace more of what the book was about and not worry about all the, the other stuff that goes on in rooms and the other talk. He really explained a lot of things to me, and you know, so it came later. And I probably have had four or five female sponsors, and I noticed what you said earlier. I have a male sponsor, and it works very well for me. I've had a male sponsor for the last 4 or 5 years, and it was probably one of the best. He's just a really good example of the program, and it was probably one of the best choices I ever made. So, and that's just for me. But, you know, the men and women sticking with each other, again, that's one of those things that, you know, it's nice in theory, but, you know, it really comes down to whatever works for someone. And for me, what really worked is having somebody that literally told me, you know, I've got your back, and I'll walk through the gates. What he told me were probably the most beautiful words I've ever heard from another human being. And we sat down back to back, and he said, okay, I've got this part of the world, and you can see the other half. So I've got this side, and you've got that side. And I said, okay. And he said, I'll sponsor you for a day or until you want to stop. And he said, I will walk through the gates. He said, I will walk through anything with you, but if you decide that you want to go drink again, he said, I'll walk you to the gates of hell, but I won't go in with you, but I'll stand outside and wait for you when you're done.
How nice.
Yeah, it really, and, you know, it was just one of the things for me that really opened me up in ways, as far as he really got me to understand things that I couldn't really understand before, because the way I grew up, it was very, very backwards. So, you know, it just made sense to me to have a sponsor who really just got me on various levels, and I'd been through a lot of trauma. And he was just very, and still is, he's a very, he works with all kinds of people. You know, I have a lot of different friends that sponsor all kinds of people. So it works.
Now, you're a very attractive woman. So was this an older man? Or
thank you.
Was there any, thank you, welcome. Now, was
well,
this an older fellow?
Man. No, he's a very attractive man, but it's, you know, we're friends. It's, you know, he's a sponsor. He's a friend, and he's someone that I greatly admire. If I didn't admire him as a human being, I wouldn't have asked him to sponsor me. I asked him because I was really attracted to the way he lives his life and the way he conducts himself. And I listened to him for a long time, probably about 5-6 years. Before I asked him, and I wasn't having much success with women sponsors. It just, unfortunately, I think it was my choosing, and I kept picking the same kind of, it's sort of like when they say you pick the wrong relationship and you know, romance romantic relationships. I kept choosing the same kind of female sponsor to a degree, and that, you know, most of them either went out, and usually it was around 17, 18 years. I did have one that I really liked, and she worked for a while, but for me, but, and I don't mean worked as far as, you know, money or anything like that, but it just we got to a point where it just didn't, actually I did the Wally P, which is what you were referring to, on the back of basics, and I found that to be very beneficial. That I think, especially when you've been sober a while, I think it's a very beneficial thing to do, and get back and do your steps, and you know, It woke me up again in that area. Yeah, absolutely.
I have his book, and I like that. That's the way I do it. I try the Joe McHugh method, you know, 28 to 45 days. I try to get him through quicker. On the website, I have a fellow, Michael M., out of Chicago, and we have the videos, 4 videos, and the it's called a 12 and 24 Dr. Bob times 5,000. Dr. Bob had 5,000 guys come through the hospital, and they considered him sponsor, but they sponsored pretty quick back then. There was no lollygagging around. There was no dragging a fourth step out and, you know, War and Peace kind of deal. So on the website, there's taking someone through all 12 steps in 24 hours, just using the big book. And the explanation why, where.
Right. And I actually think that the reason a lot of my relationship with the women that sponsored me was that I actually went out when I was with one. She had me wait too long to go. It was always it was too regimented for me, and it was too, like, we're going to do this in a couple of weeks, we'll do that in a couple of weeks. And I really wanted to, especially this last time that I had gone out, although it was a while back, it was, I'd been through a real devastating loss, and I really needed to get to core things right away, and I couldn't seem to find anybody that would really, go through steps with me faster. And I kind of did everything a little bit backwards. I didn't go 1 through 12. I jumped into, the first three are really more spoken than written, although I did the writing on it. But I jumped into my men's very quickly because I'd been there, done that a few times. So it was very important to me to do what felt right because I was so afraid that I would drink.
I believe that you could do the first three steps sitting at a traffic light, as long as it's not a traffic light in New York City. Because the New York City traffic light is in a New York minute is filled with the annoyed nanosecond.
Yeah. I think the New York's traffic lights are a little bit safer than ones in L.A. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I'm being glib, but the point is that the first three steps are in agreement. They used to do it on their knees. It was called a surrender. Dr. Bob, it's an interesting, I have it on the website, and it was a little understanding that I received, a little discernment. Dr. Bob, when he finally was ready, his bottom was when Bill had to buy him beer so he could do his surgery after the AMA convention. He was shaking. He had the shakes.
Right.
Bill went out and bought him some beer. And here's this drunken stockbroker has got to buy this doctor alcohol so he can do his surgery. And I believe it was that humiliation was Dr. Bob's bottom. And he came back in from that surgery, and the first words out of his mouth was, "I'm going to go through with it." And he went around the town making his amends. And that was his last drink, was purchased by Bill W., and that's Dr. Bob's story. So that has a lot to do with that men's is huge. I mean, if the promises come before we're halfway through, we'll know a new freedom and a new happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the work has to be done. Four is huge, and five is the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. Did you find that when you worked your fourth step, fifth step?
Which one? I've done the fourth step many times. I think every time you work the steps, I think there's a big, the big fear of doing the steps is, for me it was terrifying, and I hear that over and over and over. And if there's one thing I can say to anyone who hasn't, if you find someone that you trust, and trust is such an important element, because you have to find somebody that you feel comfortable with. It's not going to, sponsors are just, to lead you through the steps, not to tell you how to live your life or who to go out with or to become your relationship sponsor or anything else, or to help you with the steps. And, it took me a while before, as I said, that I found that. And I struggled in my sobriety with not ever feeling like, every fourth step was different. Let me just put it that way. I always had something different. It became easier. I think as you stay sober, getting sober is really hard, but now I really get the whole thing is about, once you're sober, how difficult it can be to stay sober. And, when I first came in the rooms, I just thought everybody was a liar. And I think that's normal, and I couldn't imagine anybody going a week or 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, 6 months, a year, without a drink. It was like, right, sure, Yeah, it's amazing when it really is true for you. And I think my most humiliating moment was when I think I was sober about 2 months in this last time, and I thought I had thrown all my vodka bottles away. And my son was six at the time, and he found, oh, this makes me feel emotional. He found like four or five bottles that had various amounts of vodka left in it. So if I put them together, I could have had like, you know, a good run on one last, you know, drink, which would have been pretty much a very large bottle of vodka. And he threw them at me.
I call those the last hurrah. It's the thought an alcoholic will have. You know, I'm going to do it just one more time, and then I'm really going to stop this time.
Right. Well, no, the point is that I didn't drink. I poured it all down the sink. What was hard for me was that my son threw my bottles at me. So I literally felt like he was throwing my disease at me. That, you know, all the things that bothered that little boy when I was drinking, he really showed me. And it was really hard. And I remember him telling me one time, he told me a story about something that I had done, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I looked at him and I realized that I didn't remember it. And I told him, I said, Dylan, honey, I apologize. And he said, I'm not lying, and you're just telling me. I said, no, I believe you, but you need to understand, I don't remember, I don't have the same memory of the situation that you're talking about as you do. I said, so, you know, mommy's really sorry. And I said, there might be some other things that I did that I don't remember, but we'll talk about them. And, you know, I'll always listen to you when you tell me something, and I would never call you a liar or think that you're making something up. You know, I had a lot of shame around, you know, the drinking that I did after his father died. But, you know, I was going through my own thing as far as not feeling like, with the way that I was raised, I didn't think I was a good enough mother. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to do anything, you know, when it came to raising this child. And then I realized that I, in order to give him a childhood that I never had, that I had to get sober and I had to maintain that. And you know, I've not been the perfect parent, but I've really worked very hard to be there for him in any way that I could. And he's turned out to be an amazing young man, and I'm very lucky. I'm beyond lucky. A friend of mine said that if you, who knew me as a teenager, he said if you rate success in money and cars and stuff like that, it's one thing. He said, but if you rate how a person changes, a human being changes over time, he said, I would say that you are one of the most successful, amazing women I've ever met. And that just brought tears to my eyes because he knew me as a teenager. So he knew how much I had gone through. And I think we all go through a lot, you know, and we don't have to. We really don't have to. We don't have to beat ourselves up. We don't have to tear ourselves down. And we don't have to go through a lot of the stuff that we put ourselves through. You know, we as in the generic, and I'm really speaking about myself. I wish I had known a lot of things, you know, but, you know, it's always that hindsight is 20/20. But, you know, I'm very lucky that at this point my son is not in the rooms. I hope he never makes it into the rooms. You know, he knows where to go if he ever had a problem. But, you know, I think probably the best thing that's ever happened to me. So,
great. Now, okay, so step five, did you have a spiritual awakening at that step, or it didn't really come until nine for you?
I don't think it was at a step. I think for me it was I was in a room one day, and I was dumbfounded. Someone was talking, and I thought, I didn't think about drinking today. And that to me was an amazing thing. It was like, wow, I can't believe I haven't thought about drinking today. And, you know, of course, in meetings, that's all we talk about is drinking. So it really, yeah. I think that for me was probably the biggest thing that ever happened to me, was having the realization that I wasn't craving a drink. And it was like, is that going to go away? Is that going to stay? Or how do I preserve that? How do I, you know, jar it? What do I do? And, you know, I was very lucky with the group of people that I found when I got sober this time. I had a group of guys, they called it Death Row in the back, that were ex-convicts and people who had been through a lot of post-traumatic stress stuff. And they were very protective of me. and they really let me get out a lot of my anger, a lot of my fear. They just let me kind of just rail. The wonderful thing about AA is that you can't get thrown out. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, that's, yeah, it's also the great leveling of the playing field. It doesn't matter how much money you make or don't make. It doesn't matter whether you're homeless or you own the biggest home. You know, we all share that one thing in common. And I always really believe that when you really have that true love of one alcoholic to another, you just really get each other on a almost cellular basis. It's you can't really compare it to anything. You know, people just, and that's the wonderful thing about the program too, is that people just, you know, get each other. We can shortcut a lot of our talks.
Yes, that's what I value about it also. And
unfortunately,
here in the Houston area, some of the groups have gotten the idea that they can ban people. But that's another story for another night.
Well, that kind of happens everywhere. But that's, you know, that's when they say get your coffee pot and you just, that's why there's so many meetings in L.A. It's, you know, grab your coffee pot and you can make another meeting. It's we have more meetings in L.A. on pretty much everything. I think that we probably even have a split-end meeting. I'm joking. But, you know, it's...
Split-end's anonymous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's meetings for everything. But, you know, the core of it... I actually, too, I was very lucky to hear a man who had met Dr. Bob he met Bill. And everyone, of course, you know, was asking him, you know, what was it like and, you know, what's the answer and you know, his very simple answer, he said that he had talked to Bill and he asked him, he said, how does it work? I mean, how did you guys come up with this? And Bill told him, he said, we just stumbled on it. And he said, we really don't know. And he said, you know, it just works. And I thought, you know, that's kind of a really cool answer because, you know, especially coming from a founder, you know, our co-founder, I just really enjoyed what, you know, hearing that answer. It was very, very simple and very honest. It wasn't like, you know, magic potion time or anything like that. And so, you know, I've just been very lucky in this sobriety.
Part that we know how it works, we just don't know why it works.
Yeah. I'm just very lucky with the people that I've had in my life, and I've had a lot of ups and downs, and you know, it's like anything else. I'm much more careful about who I let into my life and who I let get close to me because it's no different than anything in life. It's you have to be careful about who you listen to, and if you're feeling, especially when you're new, or if you're feeling vulnerable and you've been around for a while, it's really important to have people around you that are supportive.
You finished up the steps, right? You finished them up.
Oh, many times. Many times.
And have you sponsored anybody?
I don't, like, 1 through 12 sponsor. I don't think it's something that you know, has worked for me. What I do is I usually, you know, I certainly have helped a lot of people, and, you know, I get a lot of gratification of that. I usually will help people and help them find a sponsor. And I think that works better for me. I tend to become a little too attached, I think, in certain ways with people. And again, it comes down to, you know, what's healthy for me. And, you know, so I do so many different kinds of work that in working with others, whether they're loaded or not, that for me, I really, you know, I know good sponsors. I know which people are really good at sponsoring. I know who the bad sponsors are. And I will help people that way.
My experience is like with real life is that 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. What I try to get people to understand, it's in the 12 and 12 under step 5, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So it's asking us not only to speak a fifth step, but to hear a fifth step. And until then, we still didn't belong. We were just circling the field waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline. What do you think about that statement?
Well, I don't, you know, I've had so many conversations with people that are so in-depth that I everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Okay.
I've sat with people for many hours talking about things that they wouldn't open up, you know, with anyone about. And I don't think that, you know, I think that's as valuable as anything else. You know, I've sat with
friends. I think you'd be a great sponsor, Eva Marie.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, I hear that a lot. I've sat with friends, like I was just saying, I've sat with friends who are dying, and I don't know many, you know, people that sat with the same people. And you know, I think it's all relative. You know, it depends on, I mean, it really comes down to how you look at it. I think sponsorship is, you know, a very important thing. I I'm not putting it down, certainly. I just think that there are some people, like in anything else, that are more equipped. I mean, we start helping each other out when we're a couple of days sober anyway. So, I mean, that's sponsoring. It's just that I don't go through the whole 12 steps. I just don't feel that it's something that I'm particularly good at. I think there are other people that are far more qualified than me.
And that's a great idea, being one who helps people find a good sponsor. And after being around a long time, you can recognize who would be good at it and who wouldn't. I like that idea. Hey, I am dying to hear about the 12 angels.
Okay. Oh, well, I'd love to tell you about it. I just found out yesterday that I was going to some meetings, and I had heard about this wonderful group. It's actually out of a center called 180 Center, and you can look that up online at oneaocenter.com here in L.A. And it's a nonprofit organization under the umbrella of 180 Center that basically helps people in recovery. There's and the founder, Alex Showett, believes that that the part of that we miss often in getting sober, and I totally believe that, I totally agree with this, is that you know, when we want to go back to work and so forth, it's a very difficult transition getting back into life. You know, it was for me, and I know it is for a lot of other people, and there's a real high rate in relapse in that. One of the things that he had found was trying to make up stories for where he'd been for 60 or 90 days when he was getting sober. And what this organization is it's for mentoring and helping people not only find jobs but create businesses. And right now my son is the resident artist, and he's actually mentoring a young man in his art. And the change in the young man that he's helping in three lessons has been unbelievable. The change in his and they help each other out. It's again one of those things that is very, you know, synonymous with Alcoholics Anonymous and the whole giving back. They really help each other out in talking and having conversations and you know. It's going to move in a lot of different directions. It'll be hopefully multimedia, and you know, instead of telling people just go get any job you can get, go to Starbucks, go to Home Depot. Those seem to be the, you know, normal kind of things that sponsors tell their sponsees. It's more about, you know, what's your passion in life? What do you love to do? And we're here to help people find what their passion is, or if they've had a job and you know, it's aligning them with somebody that can help them out and get them back in the workforce.
Oh, that's great. I know some folks, especially most of the time I go to high bottom clubs, groups, etc. And I seem to work better with professionals for some reason. They seek me out, doctors, lawyers, and Indian chief kind of guy. But the fellows who come in on the 24-hour clubs, sometimes they're just coming in fresh from the street, and they have
right.
no resources at all. Their day is completely taken up with minimal survival.
Right.
And it's tough for them to make a phone call, and to get a shower, to get a hot meal might take most of the day to accomplish those mundane things that we take for granted.
Right.
So to get into
the
workforce.
The homeless is I hear you. I also just wanted to quickly get in that I've worked with the homeless as well, and 180 Center and 12 Angels also does work with several other organizations that help people get work, and the homeless organization Get Love is actually Eileen Getty's organization, and that helps people not only get showers and clothing and all of that, but it helps people get homes. And I don't mean homes. I mean apartments and condos and places to live, and very successfully. So it's again, it's for me working with people. I work with people that are mentally ill, high, not high. My son teaches a homeless art class as well. The only requirement is that you treat another human being with respect. So there's no fights. It's great. It's really beautiful. So it's.
I like that. It kind of directs these people into getting out of themselves, I think, and just to see that there's more beauty in the world. And I think that, because usually by then you've lost most hope. Society has washed their hands of you. You're considered just trash, and that people would rather not even look at you. All of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that. And the spirit has gone out of their eyes, and they're beaten into a state of hopelessness. And something like that, to bring them back into a level of art agreement, that's wonderful. That's a great therapy. What do you think, Harold?
Oh, absolutely. The taproot of the whole problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. We've got to get out of ourselves. So say more about working with the homeless.
I'm sorry?
Say more about working with the homeless.
I say more about it?
Yeah. What's it like?
Well, what's it like? I've actually had homeless people come in that I know into meetings when I've spoken. And I will say this, and I had a room complaint to the secretary because I didn't kick the guy out. He was loaded. He was talking to me. I was answering him. He was a heckler. He was really happy to be there. He didn't know what he was doing. And, he was high. And I said, he's in the right place. He's where he belongs. And apparently some people didn't agree. It's amazing to me how even in the room sometimes our perceptions and our feelings about who belongs and who doesn't kind of come to the forefront, and it's really not very nice. But, I love being around. I call them, basically my homies. I have, quite a few friends and that, we have graduated from, being homeless and now have a place. And, they teach me. They teach my son. They teach, they really. I actually sat with a friend who's a photographer, and he introduced me to another photographer, and we were sitting on Hollywood Boulevard, and they were showing me all these, pictures they've taken of the poor around the world, and I said, well, these are really beautiful pictures, but your shot's right there, and it was a homeless man looking through the garbage, and he said, I'd never take a picture of someone like that, and I said, why not? And he said, it's humiliating, and I said, well, what are you showing me? You're showing me people around the world, and it's, that's kind of an ego boost because you can go around the world and show people that are having a hard time, but what about America? I mean, America's not doing so well.
Good point.
We need to start taking care of our own, and we need to take care of, it's like what you were talking about with the family. The family extends to, your neighbor and people that are around you. So it's my thought and my thinking is that, we should, treat each other how we want to be treated, and that's not original thinking. But you know, I think I wrote you guys and showed you some of my short films, and those are very much about the differences that we have in life and overcoming them and hopefully overcoming them with humor. I mean, humor is a huge thing. Laughter is like so important. So with the short film Shorty and Morty that I have, I've gotten like an incredible little. I showed that to the homeless, and it's about an extraordinary homeless couple that live in Hollywood, and they loved it. They loved it. There wasn't like a moment where anyone said, you know, that you're making fun of me. It was like they totally related. And I think that moment for me was one of the nicer moments that I've had working with the homeless.
Okay, so now how do I find that? It's on YouTube. I have the link on the marquee for the show, but say someone else is listening, they don't want to go to the marquee. How do I find that short?
If you look up, you won't find the short because I haven't gotten them released yet. One's still in the process. I'm waiting to see if it's going to be in a film festival. I have two shorts, and it's Shorty and Morty with Y, Shorty and Morty. You can find my blog, which is a continuation of the characters and builds out on more. If you just look up Shorty and Morty, Shorty and Morty's Hollywood Homelesshood. You'll find other, or shortyandmorty.com. You'll see a lot of the press on the first one. It's pretty much all over. If you just look up E.M. Frederick, you'll find, and Shorty and Morty, a lot of things will come up. And you'll see the trailers to the movies. And I'm hoping very shortly with 12 Angels to not only have a multimedia show, I would like to also show the shorts because my son did the artwork. He production designed, and as you know, he acted in it. He had the very first short is the world's most extraordinary homeless couple crashes Hollywood's most bizarre 12-step meeting, and that's a puppet addict meeting. And I got the puppeteer Scott Land from Team America to loan me a couple of marionettes. I have a black Christopher Walken marionette, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, Christopher Walken. That was one of the you know, I know that voice, but I could. Now I got it.
Right. And one of the actors. Thank you. One of the actors in that. Well, actually, he's more of an editor than an actor. It was his first acting that I think that he's done. I could be wrong, so apologies, Emery, if I'm wrong on that. He did that voice, and I did the voice of Ellen. So, and no one, of course, listening is going to know that unless they see the trailer. I have a YouTube page under Eva Marie Frederick, and you'll see a lot of the interviews or characters within characters. And at first, you know, most people do, like, the actor talking about the character. I have them being interviewed by another character, which is a social worker, and they're all looking for – he's trying to find out more about Shorty and Morty. So it's been a lot of fun, and that's something that I'm very passionate about and want to continue with because it touches on all levels of addiction, all types of addiction, and you know, and what this, you know, what I think is going on with, you know, my perception of what's going on with this, with our world, this country, and how I think we can help. Hopefully.
Hand puppet addiction. How did you know?
Huh?
And puppet addiction. How did you know?
You know, that one just kind of came to me, and it was just, I thought, you know, what would be a really different meeting? And I thought, well, only in L.A. would they have, like, a puppet addict meeting. And you know, it just, and then I found out it's a real thing. I had no idea.
Get out of here. I could understand if it was hand puppet addiction, but just plain puppet addiction makes no sense to me.
No, it's more in the vein of, like, you know, like the sex puppets. It's more in the vein of that, guys. You know, I know I'm talking in the Bible Belt. Sorry, but you know that's why there's a bar and a church on every corner. But yeah, it's a lot of fun, and you know, it really addresses mental illness and things like that, too, which is a large part of addiction, of any
kind. It is. Yes.
It's
yes.
huge, you know. I mean, yeah. I'll tell you this about my family, and you know, I'm very happy that I had the family that I did growing up. I don't think I would have. I've lived a very rich life, and I don't mean as far as money, but it certainly has opened my eyes to a lot of things in as far as human nature and humanity. I've always said this. We have the only alcoholic parakeet. We had a parakeet that would actually fly over to the stove, lift off the gas thing, and sniff gas.
Oh no!
And try to fly, and he'd always crash into something. But you know, it was. I mean, what other family would have a bird that would do something like that other than our family? His name was Jerry, and Jerry didn't live very long. We, you know, one of the cats got him, but it was on one of his gas sniffing days. So. No.
That's very funny.
It's true too. I'm not making it up. It's very true. But getting back to 12 Angels, I'm very much looking forward to. We just restarted this portion of the program, and it's I'm just so honored to be asked to lead this, and it's growing very organically. It's you know, I just think there's going to be a lot of success with it, and it's all about, you know, I mean, we're supposed to help each other out. We're not supposed to let each other suffer, and that goes, you know, across the board, you know, with whether it's jobs or housing or just lending an ear, and you know, it's extremely important. So
we only keep what we give away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's exactly.
On the note of mental health, I like to think of it this way. The wealthy are always considered eccentric. But the poor
mm-hmm.
can't afford eccentric. They just have to settle for just plain crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah.
AA
and
is not a hotbed of mental health. That's, you can count on that.
No. No. And it's not. It's, and sometimes the person that looks the happiest and smiling the most is on the most meds. So I'm always a little careful about who I choose to, you know. It's like I hear that a lot in rooms. Go to the happiest person in the room and ask them to sponsor you. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? You know, you sit and I always tell people to, you know, spend some time and listen to people for a while before you choose a sponsor. You know,
you
certainly
know,
you have someone.
On the website, we have how to find a sponsor, and part of that, there's an interview for a sponsor. What do you think of that?
Right.
Is that a great idea?
I think it's a great idea. I do. I've always kind of laugh when people say I fired somebody, and it's like nobody gets paid anything here. So I'm mm-hmm. what's this hiring and firing? It gets to be a little bit much. I mean, you know, I think. My friendships sometimes have been as deep, if not deeper, than being sponsored. You know, the sponsorship
sure.
is basically the steps. You know, you get double if you're lucky and your sponsor ends up being a good friend, too, and I've been lucky that way. You know, so, yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah, it's
if you have any more questions, we need to start closing it up. Anything else that you'd like to say, Eva Marie?
Yeah, I'd like to say since it's Father's Day that my son, I love you, because I know he's listening, and I'm very lucky that I have the family that I do.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been delightful.
Thank
you.
You
have a great story, and if we can help in any way get your message out, we're more than happy to do that. Huh, Harold, you got anything?
Yes, this has been a very interesting program. I really like the idea of the caution in looking for a sponsor. Do not go to the happiest person in the room. that's a great caution. And listen to people. You will hear your story told through other people's voices.
Exactly.
And that's the beauty of it. And listen and go to lots of meetings, but I encourage folks to get started on the 12 steps
as soon as possible. There's a lot to be gained from working the steps with pen and paper.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harold. Well, in closing, I'd like to
thank you very much.
You're welcome. Our pleasure. In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and we're over 300,000 hits to the website. There's no money being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. So it's a good work, and it's going around. Matter of fact, I send out a missive, which is a note of importance on Facebook, and it has Sister Ignatia. Sister Ignatia was one of the founders of AA. She was not one of us in that sense. She helped the alcoholic in Akron, Ohio with Dr. Bob when he worked with the 5,000. She was called the Little Angel of Mercy. And she's been nominated, and actually the post on the website is the first chipmunk started with a habit, Sister Ignatia. And she's been nominated as a saint by the Roman Catholic Church, requiring three verifiable miracles and while she was alive, and one verifiable miracle after she died. So what I've done is I've resurrected her likeness of image and her story, and I've been sending it around the world. You know why?
Why?
Because sometimes even a saint needs a leg up.
There you go.
Thanks again. Yeah,
and please
thanks
look
again,
up
Eva Marie.
12angels, 12angels.org, and that's 1-2 is in 12.
Okay, that's great. Well, good night.
Yeah.
And
good
night, Eva Marie. Good night, Harold. And
thank
we'll
you,
remember,
gentlemen.
We'll see. You're welcome. We'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.